How many people have heard of this passage? They've heard of it. They've heard of the number of the beast. How many people have actually read the passage? A few. Okay. Okay. So I picked this passage because it is the second spookiest passage in the whole Bible in honor of Halloween. Last year we talked about Daniel with the floating hand that comes through the wall and writes, but today we're talking about this passage. Several months ago, I went to Taco Bell, and I ordered a taco and like a churrito, you know, one of those cinnamon crispy things, a little churro, and a drink. And with tax, the total cost of the bill was $6.66. Oh, yes. Oh, yes, it was. Now, how many people have had something like that happen to them, where they suddenly happened upon that, it ended up in their phone number, it happened upon their address or something, and felt a little nervous? Mm-hmm. How many people can imagine feeling a little nervous? Okay. So what we have today is an excellent example of apocalyptic literature. Apocalyptic literature is a very specific genre, and it doesn't appear all the time. Nobody in a happy, healthy, wonderful society where life is good, they have plenty of money, they own their home, their food is plentiful and their children are healthy, wakes up in the morning and says, you know, I'm feeling a little bored, I think I'll write something about the cataclysmic end of the earth. It doesn't happen. Apocalyptic literature only occurs in societies where there is a pressure cooker feel in the air, where things are bad, where life is really difficult, where they don't see a way out, where they don't trust their leaders, where they don't feel like their voice is heard, where they are worried about the impending destruction of society and of life as they know it, and they don't feel that there's any way out. It is only in these particular instances where there's a complete faith in a lack of faith in the system that apocalyptic literature starts to become prevalent. This was one of those times. So, apocalyptic literature is the answer that people find when they are trapped in black and white thinking, when they only see one or two options and they're both bad. Years ago, I may have told you this before, but I'm going to tell it again. Years ago, I was involved with a UCC church in Portland, Oregon, and something bad happened. I'll tell you, I haven't told many people this, but I had been pregnant before I had Faye, and I lost that baby. And my minister, who had been so excited to tell the entire church the moment he found out I was pregnant, did not tell everybody after the bad news came. And so for every week, for months, when I would go to church, people were still coming up to congratulate me. And I had to keep breaking the news to people every single week. Or when they found out, they would then share their own sad stories, which I felt very sorry about, but really did not help me. So after months of this, I didn't go back. I got so upset, I just didn't go back. I quit going to this church that I had been part of for so many years. All I could see was two options, either leave church forever or go and be injured again and again and again, and neither were good. So the person that wrote this story, his name is John, that's what he calls himself. He should not be confused with John the Baptist or with John, the author of the Gospel of John. Those were different Johns. John's a common name. This is a completely different John. John lived in a society in the Roman Empire where society had become a pressure cooker. John is actually writing from jail. He had been arrested for preaching the good news, for trying to convert people to Christianity. He'd been physically harmed, and he had been thrown into jail on a very small island where he couldn't be in contact with anybody that he knew. And so he is seeing the destruction that the Roman Empire was causing in people's lives because they were so powerful. So in this society, Caesar Nero, who was considered to be the most cruel of Roman emperors, had just committed suicide 3 years earlier. Emperor worship and the worship of Roma, the goddess of Rome, was the religion of the day. And a few years prior, just a few years before this letter was written, Jerusalem, about 37 years after Christ had died, a small band of rebels decided they were going to overthrow the Roman Empire and oust them from Jerusalem and take back over their city. And they struggled for about 2 years and completely failed, and the Roman Empire destroyed the city. And some scholars think that John may have been there when that happened, and he was one of the refugees that fled. So he had seen it firsthand. So when we talk about a context that would be appropriate for apocalyptic literature to start popping out of, this is it. This is why John was writing. John was writing all of these things, and what he's doing is he's writing letters to seven churches, but he's got to be really careful. If he tells them, don't worry, we're going to overthrow the Roman Empire, of course, they're all going to get in trouble. He's going to get in trouble. So a lot of what he writes is in code. It's in metaphor. And it's references to the Old Testament, which was only in Hebrew at that point. Very few people had the Greek version. So if he made references to, say, the four horsemen in Ezekiel, the Roman Empire would think this guy's just a little baddie. But anybody who was a Christian would say, oh, let's go look back at what that says and see if we can uncover the message he's giving us. Does that make sense? He's writing in code. That's why there's so many of these wild images that actually have a very simple meaning, but it wasn't meant for the Roman government to find out. So, after a couple of years of not going to church at all, I had Faye. And when she was just a couple of months old, I woke up one morning and I felt a holy nudge. Have you ever felt a holy nudge? A little shove in a certain direction? And this holy nudge said, today's the day you're going to church. Go. Now, I had moved. I was not living near that church anymore. So I remembered my mother saying that she had run past an Episcopal church at some point when she had visited. So I looked it up online and found out that the worship service started in about 30 minutes. Now, I had just woken up, and I had a two-month-old. So the idea of me pulling together and getting to church on time was impossible. It's just impossible. There's no way. I'm either going to show up 45 minutes late, or I should just stay home. This is what I was thinking. But the nudge was very strong. Go, 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 go now. So I tried to throw us together, and amazingly, we got together. I was able to get dressed, get her ready to go, and we got out the door. We were going to be a few minutes late, but we were going to make it. And I was really stressed out about it. I was stressed out about the idea of going. I was stressed out about the idea of being late. And I kept telling myself, I should just stay home. Really. It's going to be terrible. It's going to be embarrassing. I don't want to go. That's one option. Or I could just stay home and not care and refuse to ever go to church again. These were my two options. But as I'm driving, as I was worried about being late, I just felt a very calm, it's okay. It's all going to be okay. You are going to be late, but it's all going to be okay. So in this story, we have two beasts, and we talk about both of them because they are interconnected. The first beast, with all the different animal parts, remember he had feet of a bear and the head of a lion and a leopard and all this kind of stuff. He's referring back to the book of Daniel where there were four beasts, the lion, the bear, the leopard, and the beast with 10 horns. And these represented in Daniel's book the big bad super empires of his time, Babylon, Media, Persia, and Greece. So when John in the book of Revelation is talking about this beast with 10 horns, he's making a direct reference back to the superpowers of the Old Testament that wreaked havoc in people's lives because they were so powerful and no one could stand up to them. And he sees this superpowers on the one hand as being the beasts of old, and at the same time as being a beast that just keeps rising up with different faces. Does that make sense? Egypt, Babylon, Greece, Persia, it doesn't matter. They're all really just the same thing in John's mind because they cause the same problems. They just have different names. So this is how he's packaging this image that he is writing about to these churches. So when he describes this beast, there are some very specific details he gives. It has 10 horns with 10 diadems. Diadem is an old-fashioned word for a little crown, kind of like a tiara that kings would wear, a little golden crown, okay? So he's making reference to the Jewish kings that were puppet kings that had been appointed by the Roman emperor and who were loyal to the Roman emperor but who were ruling over the Jewish people. Do you see that? That's part of the beast. That's part of its face. The other thing that he says is that it had 7 heads with blasphemous names. Those were the 7 Roman emperors that had ruled to that point. You see that? So this beast he's describing sounds really scary. And sometimes in movies and in books we hear about this vicious beast, but really he's just talking about the Roman Empire and its inherent corruption and how threatening it was to people. Does this make sense? You all still with me? Okay. So That's the first description of the beast. The second part of the beast he talks about as having a human form that controls the beast. So who's he talking about, really? Who controls the entire Roman Empire with the human face? The king, Caesar. That's right, he's talking about Caesar. The question is, which Caesar? And what does this number have to do about it? Because it says the whole earth followed this beast and was given authority. This beast was given authority over every tribe and every people and language and nation. That's Rome. They had spread so far at this point that they are all up in the Middle East and Asia and Africa. It was huge. But there was one guy that controlled the whole thing. The question is, which one is he talking about? So, when I got to this church, I remember it was just about this time of year, but in Portland it's really cold right now. It was a few weeks after Thanksgiving. Or a few weeks after the beginning of November. So we're getting close to Thanksgiving. And on that particular day, it was extremely cold. Gunmetal gray skies threatening to snow, icy cold wind that was really loud, so loud that if you stepped out into it, it was hard to hear. And as I pulled into the parking lot, I realized I was just like 5 minutes late. So the parking lot was deserted. No one was there, just cars. Everybody was already inside because worship had started. So as I pull into the parking lot, I see there's only one other person there. There's like a blackberry hedge up against the side of the parking lot, you know, really tall, about 12 feet tall, this big old hedge. And cars had parked along that hedge when all the spaces had been filled up. And one car that had parked up against it, I could see there was an older woman with her head above the car, and she was kind of moving. It looked like she was sort of struggling with her door or something. And so I pulled in. There were no spots here, so I figured I'd go around the building, turned the corner, and then parked facing the opposite direction. So the woman was behind me at this point. And just at exactly that moment, I glanced in my rearview mirror, and I saw the woman behind her car, in between her car and the hedge. Her head suddenly disappeared. Dropped. Whew, that fast. If I had not been in the parking lot at exactly that moment, I never would have seen her. If I had not glanced in my rearview mirror at exactly that moment, I never would have known there was a problem. I would have only assumed she had gone inside. So I put the car, parked the car really quickly, left Faye in her car seat, ran to see what had happened, and I see this woman. It turns out she was 93 years old. She was wearing like a little skirt with some nylons, you know what I'm talking about, and a thin little like cashmere sweater over a blouse. And she had struggled with her door, fallen backwards, and been caught in the blackberry bushes so that all down the back of her, all of her clothes were tangled in the bushes, and she couldn't get up. And she was behind her car, so anybody walking by wouldn't be able to see her. And anybody, if she was yelling because of the wind, could not hear her. So between her pulling on the wheel well of her car and me shoving and untangling, we got her up, and I took her inside. And my plan was to slip in the back and be all anonymous and then slip out before worship was over. But instead, I had her on my arm and my baby with me, and went and introduced her to an usher who was waiting and said, you know, she fell. I think she's okay. You know, he knew her, and they were going to check her out. And then I slipped into the back pew, preparing to wait out the service and then leave early. So there's been a lot of books and movies written about this number of the beast. There's a movie, The Omen, remember, with the kid that has like the number 666 on his scalp, you know, this kind of stuff. So this is a code. There is this stuff in the Old Testament and in Hebrew writing that is called gematria. It's number play. Every letter has a numerical equivalent. And so there's lots of game playing. And you find it in the Old Testament where people's names, you'll add them up and they'll equal numbers. Or they'll be making references to this, that, and the other that's spelled a certain way and it equals a number. Or they'll reference a number, which means they're referring to a word. And so there's a missing passage in here. If you look at some of the old scripts, the old versions that we have of this passage, there's oftentimes another line that does not always make it into our English translation. It says the number of the beast is 616. Have you ever heard that? The number of the beast is 616. But if you're really wise, it's 666. Well, that's a 50, 50-point difference now, isn't it? That's a 50-point difference. So at this point in Jewish history, Caesar Nero was considered to be the cruelest emperor of all times. You know, he used to, like, kill people and put them up as torches, you know, like in his garden parties and things like that. And he was clinically insane in so many ways. And he was extremely cruel and he was extremely nutty. And his family crest was the phoenix, you know, and the phoenix dies and then rises again and dies and rises again. So rumors circulated throughout Roman society with sort of like this, you know, will he come back? Will he come back again? You know, like we sometimes, you know, wonder, like, what, who was it that really shot, you know, Kennedy? You know, we still keep talking about it. Well, people would talk about whether or not he would rise again with just a different face, because that was his family crest and because he'd been so bad and left such a bad legacy. Now, if you take his name, Caesar Nero, and you translate it into Hebrew, guess what those letters add up to? 616. The problem is in Hebrew, they don't write their vowels, so you can't end with Nero. You have to have another consonant there. Like, we can't say, I ate a apple. We have to say, I ate an apple, right? We have to have that extra little letter to make it sound right. So you put that extra letter in it, and you get Neron Caesar. Guess how, what that adds up to? 666. That's right. 616, but if you're really wise, if you really understand the Old Testament, if you really understand how to speak Hebrew, you get the higher number. This number, when we get our little ticket from, our little receipt from Taco Bell and get so nervous because it's $6.66, fear not. The number of the beast is just a reference to a really bad ruler. We know what bad rulers are. They don't come back to haunt us. But in societies where the system allows for corruption to keep rearing its ugly head, it can be really scary. Does that make sense? Okay. So that day at church, I was getting ready. My plan was to slip out after worship, you know, right before it was over, before anybody could say hello to me, because I still had real reservations about being back at church after so long. But during the passing of the peace, that usher ran to the minister to tell him what had happened. And so the minister came straight up to me in the middle of worship service, right at the passing of the peace, and says, "Oh, hello! I understand that you're the woman who saved Mrs. Getz's life." And everybody heard this, and rumors spread, and I had about 48 people that day greet me as the woman who saved Mrs. Getz's life. So much for being anonymous. I got a warm welcome. It was a safe place. They sent me home with some of the most delicious, light and buttery shortbread I've ever had in my entire life. And I kept going back. And I kept going back. And it was in that church that I felt the call to ministry. It was in that church a couple years later that I felt that call to pursue the ministry. So when we look at today's society, we see a prevalence of apocalyptic literature. Think about how many movies and books and video games and songs and graphic novels and comic books have come out that talk about a society that has a cataclysmic event. The method may change. Sometimes it's a tornado, sometimes it's a hurricane, sometimes it's an earthquake, a volcano, a monster, an alien spaceship, a zombie invasion, vampires, you name it. It destroys the earth, brings it back down to crumb, especially around Halloween, right? Think Star Wars. Think about Star Wars. The whole planet is destroyed, and then a very small rebel force of really good people rise again to try and rebuild society brick by brick. You with me? So when we see this, what it tells us is that our youth are trying to tell us something about what they're experiencing. This tells us that our artists and our poets are trying to tell us something about how society feels to them, and what kind of options they see and what kind of thinking they're trapped in. And the good news, my friends, the good news is, even though, just like with John, even though he was trapped in black and white thinking, God had bigger, more hopeful options for us. We trust that there's a higher power that will do better for us than we can even imagine doing for ourselves. A lot of people are still waiting for John's vision to happen. But the reality is, he was predicting that the Roman Empire would be slayed by God. That was the only thing he could imagine that would make everything okay again. And yet, Jesus never showed up with a sword. There were never rivers of blood. What ended up happening was, the Emperor Constantine found Christ under some suspicious circumstances. But he converted, and he made Christianity the national religion of the Roman Empire, which meant Christians weren't persecuted anymore. The Roman Empire did eventually fall many years later, but not like John predicted, and Jerusalem was rebuilt. So much more different, such a completely unheard of option that John could never see when he was writing this letter to these other churches. So a couple months later, I got a little, I forget how I heard, through the grapevine, through a wild email that came through, something, that at my old church, the minister was retiring, and they were having a going away party for him. Now, I had been upset, but I didn't want to just, you know, never see him again. So I decided I would go. At this point, I had Faye, who was almost two, and I was pregnant with Rosemary. And so I went to that retirement party, and you know what? I was expecting people to be angry with me and resentful, and where the heck have you been, and who do you think you are, and why did you leave? And everyone just gave me hugs and said, "Oh my God, is this your child? She is so beautiful. We are so glad to have you back." And that church ended up supporting me all the way through seminary, all the way through my first call as a minister, and they were my church for 16 years. I'm still good friends with most of the people in that church. Healing happened. Forgiveness happened. An option I never even imagined was possible happened. And it was so much bigger and so much more beautiful than I could ever imagine when I was trapped in all I can see is pain or complete and total withdrawal. That's all I can see, pain or withdrawal. Healing, forgiveness, hope, reconciliation, friendship, love, fellowship were not even in my realm. And yet they were all there waiting for me. So as we look at what our youth are thinking in regards to this society, as we look at the prevalence of apocalyptic literature, I'd like to remind you that God is still working and God is still speaking. There is still hope to be found. There is still positive things happening in this world. Did you know that in California they have decided that solitary confinement is a cruel and unusual punishment and decided to release all the prisoners that are in solitary confinement back into the general prison population so they can reconnect with society? This is good news, my friends. Syrian refugees are being invited to Iceland in record numbers. Thousands of people, tens of thousands of people are inviting them into their homes, saying they will be our future spouses for our children. They will be our future friends, our future pew mates in churches. We cannot wait to have them. Oslo, those worried about climate change, Oslo was the first city in the entire world to ban cars completely. I think this was after Beijing decided that it was going to ban cars for 2 weeks just to see if it could clear its skies, because they were having to project sunsets onto giant screens so that people could see sunrises and sunsets because the smog was so thick they couldn't see them otherwise. So they banned cars for 3 weeks. The skies cleared. They have blue skies and sunshine, and they're seeing sunsets and sunrises for the first time in years. So Oslo banned cars completely. Completely. And at this point now, 6 European cities have plans to establish car-free zones in central areas. And they're putting in public transportation to be able to make sure that people can still get to and from work. Did you know that the Vatican just declared that people who are divorced can come back for communion? Talk about reconciliation and healing after years of ostracism. Did you know that guerrilla grafters in San Francisco, that's a thing now, guerrilla grafting, they're taking fruit trees. And for, you know, decorative trees that are around the sidewalks and stuff, they're grafting fruit branches onto them so that people wandering by will have a source of free and organic fresh fruit whenever they want it. Yeah. Yeah. Did you know? Do you remember that guy I don't remember his name, that took the HIV drug and increased the price from $13 a pill to $3,750 a pill. Right. And then he finally backed down because public outcry was so huge. There's a new competitor in town that's producing the exact same pill, and just out of spite, they decided to lower it to $1 a dose just to put him out of business. They decided to lower it to $1 a dose. New York City had plans to plant 1 million new trees. They're 2 years ahead of schedule. They're just about to finish. Killer whales, which were becoming a more and more rare sight in the Seattle area. They have discovered there are 5 new killer whales, and all the ones that were currently there are now fat and healthy and doing very, very well. The population is coming back after much work to clean up the waters and stop the fishing practices that were harming that population. And 8 Arctic countries just decided to sign a historic Coast Guard deal so that sailors and fishermen that get into trouble in those waters can receive the help that they need without having to worry about diplomatic problems preventing them from getting help if they've wandered into waters that are not their own. This is good news, my friends. Sometimes we get so caught up in black and white thinking. Sometimes we get so worried about all of the things that are going wrong in our world. It's easy to forget that our God has so many more possibilities for us. Jesus promises us that there is good news, that this world, God is building a beloved community right here, right now, a just community filled with peace and joy, where people can live together, where everyone has enough. And when we look, when we close out all the distractions and just look, we see God's presence and we see God working and we see the positive signs of this community being built right here in front of us, and we get to be invited to help with it. The youth that are so enjoying all of this apocalyptic literature, that are so enjoying the movies and the graphic novels and the video games about the destruction of the end of the earth, sat right here this morning and decided to write a letter to someone they've never met before so that they can learn how to help other children in need. If that's not good news, if that doesn't give you hope in our future, hope in the future generations, I don't know what else will. Can I get an amen to that?